Today, understanding George Soros, how he spends his money, and why he attracts so many enemies. And Professor Leah Upi on the millions of migrants who won't be able to vote in December's election.
George Soros was someone that I'd wanted to interview for a long time.
Sean Walker is The Guardian's Central and Eastern Europe correspondent.
I've worked in Russia for 10 years, and the last year and a half I've been based in Budapest, and Soros has been, in Hungary, the key bogeyman that pretty much the entire political discourse is built around. In many other countries, a sort of figure who often comes up as a kind of evil mastermind.
Philadelphia has been utterly transformed by a Soros-backed candidate. I don't know. That doesn't look like democracy to me.
Soros-occupied State Department.
The Democrats, George Soros.
The foundation, the George Soros. Qualche dubbio inizia.
Or now, are George Soros who declared losses?
Her embassy is funding George Soros's groups in Ukraine. George Soros is sort of an ideologue.
So we've been trying for ages, and finally we got the approval. And it almost felt a little bit like an anticlimax because you sort of, you hear so much about this evil mastermind that you kind of expect you're going to be taken through series of double doors past aides and stuff. And I sort of walk into the corridor and there is George Soros sitting at a desk looking very much like an 89-year-old man.
George Soros is one of the world's best-known billionaires and philanthropists. A man who has supported democratic causes across the globe. Beginning in his home country of Hungary in the 1980s, through to the UK now, where he supports a prominent group campaigning against Brexit. But his work has turned him into a hate figure for the right, a man who has become the subject of conspiracy theories and whose name has become a byword for anti-Semitism. From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, meeting George Soros. What were your first impressions?
So from the one hand, I see this face and I think, gosh, well, I know this face because the year I've been living in Budapest, I've been seeing it enlarged on enormous billboards all around the city telling you that he's sort of trying to destroy their way of life. On the other hand, the fact that he's built up so much as a kind of all-powerful person, you're initially a little bit taken back of like, oh yes, it is just a little 89-year-old man who speaks very, very slowly.
Is that good?
Yeah, go ahead.
And his hearing has almost completely gone. So to interact with him, you're given little handheld microphones, which goes directly to his hearing aid. I think actually the start of the interview, I startled him by speaking incredibly loudly directly into it. And he said, yeah, that's a little bit too loud.
So here you are in front of this man who we hear so much about. And as you say, actually is just a man. That's because the reason we hear so much about him is because he's very influential when it comes to thinking about what societies should look like. Where did he grow up and what experiences did he have that influenced where he ended up?
So I think when you go back and look at Soros's biography, it's really, I think, one of the extraordinary lives of the last century. So he was born in Hungary in 1930. His original name was Gyorgy Schwartz, and he was given the name Soros. His father chose it because it sounded less Jewish. Obviously, the war starts when he's still very young. In 1944, when the Nazis kind of officially occupy Hungary, Soros goes into hiding. He's separate from his parents and his brother. And it's clearly a very scary time, but the family does survive. After the war finishes and communism is imposed on Hungary, and I think Soros feels very stifled by this new system, and he manages to make his way to London in 1947 as a 17-year-old. And he does a kind of series of odd jobs in London. I think he's working as a waiter. He's working as a swimming pool lifeguard. He's working as someone who attaches the wigs to mannequins in a mannequin factory. And then a couple of years later, he manages to get into the LSE.
The London School of Economics. Is that where he became passionate about democracy?
Well, that's definitely, I think, the start of it. He studies under the Austrian philosopher Karl Popper at the LSE. So Popper has written this book, The Open Society and Its Enemies, where he talks about the benefits of open societies over closed societies. And Soros latches onto this. And even when he was working in finance, he was sort of mulling over these questions of what is the best society? What is an open society? How can you promote an open society?
Thinking back to when I was a teenager, I don't remember George Soros being famous for his philosophy, more for his money. How did he get so rich? Was it luck?
It's an interesting one. I think it's a mix. I mean, clearly it wasn't just luck. He's both somebody who's always trying to get better informed about what he's working with, but also a very instinctive investor. He's said that one of the biggest reasons behind his success was being able to quickly acknowledge mistakes. So he would maybe go in quickly, but then come out quickly if it looked like the wrong thing. He would kind of move in and out of markets without necessarily forming kind of sentimental attachment to him.
You say he has an instinct for philanthropy, and we know that his kind of driving ideology is around an open society, around freedom and democracy. When he started spending that money, where did he begin?
His first major project was in Hungary, going back to his birthplace, beginning to sense these forces that were growing in opposition to the communist regime and wondering how he could support them. Very quickly, he's giving away pretty large amounts of money. And, you know, some of his first projects in Hungary, for example, were importing a huge number of Xerox photocopiers so that dissidents could get their message out.
Photocopiers?
Yeah.
How did that work?
If you were in a country where the government controls all the printing presses and you have no way to get your message out, of course it's pre-internet and so on, if you have a photocopier, then you can suddenly mass produce literature, leaflets, newsletters and so on.
So it's like Facebook in the 1980s.
Indeed, yeah.
The 6 o'clock news from the BBC.
He became famous here in the 1990s as the man who broke the Bank of England.
The government raises interest rates twice in one day to 15% in its all-out battle to prop up sterling.
It's since become known as Black Wednesday, when on the 16th of September 1992 the pound collapsed and it had to be withdrawn from the European exchange rate mechanism.
Dealers estimated at least £3 billion was spent by the Bank of England to support the currency. Central banks in France, Germany, Belgium, Holland and Spain all bought pounds, but to no avail.
What was his role in that?
Soros gets involved in basically shorting the pound, thinking that the pound is overvalued and putting a huge amount of money betting against the pound. And then he, as one of the biggest currency speculators who was making money on this, he is sort of then discovered, if you like, by the tabloids. There is sort of his picture on the front of the newspapers with the man who broke the Bank of England. He would now says that this is a little bit exaggerated, that he certainly did make a lot of money on it, but that his role as the sort of sole man who broke the Bank of England was exaggerated.
Just one of the men.
Yes, yes.
So his pushback was, I was just one of a few.
Well, no, his pushback is that, yeah, he was one of a few, but that he was very happy for his role to be exaggerated because it was exactly at that time, you know, communism had just fell. He was really getting involved in giving money away. He felt that if he had more of a name, his ideas might be taken a bit more seriously. But he certainly never shown...
One sec. George Soros liked the fact that the tabloids in the UK branded him the man who broke the Bank of England because it made him more famous.
So I think he was looking for a bit more of a name. And at least in the way that he tells it in 2019... he was quite happy to let this sort of legend appear because he felt it would give him sort of more cachet with his other ideas.
By then, Soros had been investing money in countries other than Hungary. Where else did he concentrate his efforts and why?
Back at the beginning, it was quite focused on Central and Eastern Europe, on the newly independent post-communist countries. So if you take Russia as an example, which is a country where he spent an enormous amount of money, to start with, in the early 1990s, when just after the collapse of communism, when the country was in a real mess.
The problem for shoppers here these days isn't the long lines. Russians are used to waiting in line. Their concern is what happens when they reach the end of that line. There, they'll find either bread or milk three or four times higher than they were just weeks ago, or worse, no food at all.
Soros did a couple of humanitarian interventions, which is quite rare for him. But he paid, for example, I think around 30,000 Russian scientists. He simply gave them all $500 just for them to be able to survive, and perhaps to be able to stay in Russia and to sort of save Russian science. Later on, he spent $100 million on connecting every regional university in Russia to the internet.
He thought that research was being hidden away in Russia.
Well, I think he was just aware that in Russia and across the region, the kind of communist networks of science and research all broke down. A lot of these people were impoverished, didn't have real salaries. He was really instrumental in sort of keeping these scientific communities going at a time when their national governments were unable to. When you talk about late 80s, early 90s, it wasn't just Soros that felt that everything was going in one direction, that these countries were newly opening up.
From the Berlin Wall specifically, take a look at them. They've been there since last night. They are here in the thousands. They are here in the tens of thousands. Occasionally they shout, "Die Mauer muss weg," the wall must go.
That they were embracing liberal democracy, that the world was becoming a safer and perhaps more uniform place, the end of history and so on. And I think when you talk to Soros, it comes across that he really felt like he was sort of, you know, riding a wave at that time.
There is a certain tide.
And then, as he puts it, things changed a bit and he felt the tide turning against him.
And I am very sensitive to that tide. And since I got involved in what I call my political philanthropy, the tide has turned a couple of times.
What changed?
I think there's a whole range of things that happened, starting with the 2008 financial crisis.
The closing bell at the New York Stock Exchange, the main index, down over 7%.
And perhaps culminating with the large numbers of refugees and migrants who arrived to Europe.
300 to 600 immigrants arrive here every day. This centre in Berlin is where they make their claim for asylum.
And this was the period where the name of Soros, who spoke about the need for compassion, the need for a more liberal migration policy, who funded a lot of organizations and civil society groups that were helping people who were stuck at borders.
Billionaire George Soros pledging to invest up to $500 million to help refugees and migrants. This comes after the first ever UN summit on refugees and migrants.
This is when I think these older anti-Soros tropes and some conspiracy theories really start to resurface strongly.
And by that point, George Soros was still spending his money freely, pouring funds into things he believed would boost democracy in the face of rising authoritarianism. That resulted in enemies, one of whom was Russian President Vladimir Putin. What was his key worry about Soros?
One of the things that most worried Putin about Soros was that he saw the impact of what Soros foundations were doing in neighboring countries like Ukraine and Georgia, where there were revolutions. Back in 2004 in Ukraine, when you had the Orange Revolution, that was partly sparked off by the exit polls showing a really big difference with the official final results, which led this feeling that the elections were being rigged to kind of gain momentum.
Hundreds of thousands of pro-democracy Ukrainians in the streets today protested against the results of the presidential election, pitting their candidate, the West-leaning challenger Viktor Yushchenko, against the pro-Moscow Prime Minister Viktor Yanukovych. They claim Yanukovych's victory was rigged, with reports of ballot stuffing and voter intimidation.
Exit polls funded by Soros.
Yeah, there were a number of exit polls. One of them was funded by one of Soros's foundations.
Tell me about the relationship between Soros and the leader of his home country, Viktor Orban.
At the beginning, Viktor Orban in his 20s was a sort of charismatic, young, anti-communist crusader. He was the leader of the party called the Young Democrats. And this party was partly funded by Soros.
Then, Orban was funded by Soros?
Yeah, in part. Orban himself actually got a Soros fellowship to go and study in Oxford, which he cut short because he wanted to get back to Hungary because the changes were happening so rapidly. But there is this kind of almost Shakespearean development of the relationship between them where at the beginning, Orban, like many other dissident voices in Hungary, was funded by Soros. And then he later becomes, at a very young age, prime minister, first in 2002, and slowly turns into this initially centre-right, then veering towards far-right kind of political figure. And basically, by the time we get to about 3 years ago, Orban has seen in Soros the perfect enemy and has essentially based his political vision around standing up to Soros, standing up to what he calls the Soros plan.
You're probably aware that there are large-bodied predators who are swimming here in our waters. This is the transborder empire of George Soros, with tons of money and international heavy artillery.
So it got to the point where when I arrived in Budapest a year and a half ago, the city was plastered with these giant billboards with... There was one with a cackling Soros saying, "Don't let Soros have the last laugh." There was another where opposition politicians were kind of puppets in Soros's fingers.
And that's starting to sound like some pretty nasty anti-Semitic tropes, depicting a Jewish billionaire as the puppet master. Did you see that from Orban himself?
One of the first stories I reported in Hungary was on Hungary's National Day. I went to the parliament, the square outside the parliament in Budapest, where Orban gives a speech every year. He made this kind of extraordinary speech, I thought. It really felt like this was more than simply sort of nodding to anti-Semitic theories. And Orban says, "We are fighting an enemy that is different from us, not open but hiding, not straightforward but crafty, not honest but base, not national but international. It does not believe in working, but speculates with money. It does not have its own homeland, but feels it owns the whole world." And I mean, listening to that, I just thought, wow, you couldn't have more succinctly summed up every anti-Semitic kind of trope going. And it was fairly, it was quite intense, really, to hear that literally a couple of hundred metres away from a monument to where Jews were killed in Budapest during the Second World War.
Were people cheering?
Yeah, I think people liked it.
Do you think they realised it was anti-Semitic?
I mean, I think that's always the question with this stuff. And I think, you know, we see varying levels of this with different people criticising Soros. You know, of course, the guy is a billionaire. He is very influential. He's funded an enormous amount of causes and many people disagree with it. You know, if you get into a stage where you can't say anything about Soros negatively without it being called anti-Semitic, that's a problem. At the same time, when you are talking about someone who's lived through the Holocaust, when you're listening to a speech like that from Orban that is clearly using anti-Semitic tropes, and when there is this background on the internet and on the far right of openly anti-Semitic abuse of Soros, you have to use a bit more nuance and a bit, you have to just be aware of that background when you criticize him.
And of course, Soros has become someone who we talk about much more in this country now and in the US because of his positions on Donald Trump and on Brexit. And his position on Brexit has won him some enemies in the UK who don't seem to be worried about speaking out against him, regardless of the claims about anti-Semitism. One of those is the Leader of the House, Jacob Rees-Mogg.
May I remind her that one of the major funders, allegedly, of the Remain campaign, the sort of Ramona funder-in-chief, is one George Soros, who made £1 billion when sterling crashed out of the exchange rate mechanism.
He's really attacked Soros, hasn't he?
Well, he's called him the Ramona funder-in-chief because Soros has given a couple of donations to Best for Britain, which explicitly is a group campaigning to stop Brexit.
How does Soros react to the abuse?
So I asked him what he thought about anti-Semitism in attacks against him. And he said something that he said a few times in the interview, which was that he doesn't take any of these attacks personally. This is all about differing visions of what makes a good society.
When I look at the list of people or movements or countries who are attacking me, I must be doing something right. I'm proud of the enemies I have.
I asked him a couple of times about Orban, and I said, I mean, you know, okay, you don't take this personally, but come on, this is the city where you survived the Holocaust, where there are now big laughing posters of you. Do you really not take this personally? The way he put it was that Orban was trying to make the battle personal, but it wasn't a personal battle. It was a battle about a vision of society. In fact, the only person that he did seem to get personal about was Donald Trump.
I think he's a brilliant confidence trickster who succeeded beyond his own expectations. And he's also the ultimate narcissist. So it feeds...
What's next for him?
Well, so Soros is 89. He still travels a lot. He still takes the decisions personally on where the money will go. His son, Alex, who's 34, is widely seen as someone who would take over from him. What we're going to see at the moment, you have a board of directors on each foundation that makes recommendations, and then Soros decides himself. I think it might move to a sort of more consensual, perhaps more traditional bureaucratic model where things are perhaps a bit slower and a bit less dramatic. Nice to see you in person rather than on a poster in Budapest.
Good.
Good. Thank you very much for your time. Thanks.
Sean, thank you very much.
Thank you.
That was Sean Walker. Go to theguardian.com to read the write-up of his fascinating interview with George Soros. Coming up, why those of us with the right to vote in December's election have a responsibility to the millions of migrants without. Now, despite all the twists and turns of an election, in the end, it always comes down to one person, one vote. But for millions of migrants living in the UK, including Professor Leah Upi, election day means exclusion from determining the government that will inevitably shape their lives.
I have never voted in any elections. I'm a citizen of Albania, and I left my country when I was just under the voting age. I have been a migrant for my entire adult life. I have always lived in countries long enough to care about their politics, but not long enough to be a citizen and to qualify for the right to vote. I grew up in a Stalinist country, and I was too little to vote myself, but I always watched my parents vote. They would wake up really early at 4 or 5 in the morning. The polls opened around 9 o'clock, but there was a race among citizens to try and get to the voting booths as early as possible to show loyalty with the system. There was always a lot of singing and dancing in the polls. When one went to vote, there was a whole ceremony around it. It was a day of great celebration. And I remember I was very keen to accompany my parents, and I would usually bring flowers and recite a poem about the party or something like that. And by about 10:30, the voting process was done. Officially, it was open until 7 in the evening or so, but by 10:30 it was generally known that everybody had already voted, and if you hadn't voted by then, it would be frowned upon and the Secret Services would be after you. So there was this curious ritual that everybody took part on, and there was of course only one party able to contest elections, and right after the voting booths were closed, the polls were closed, the television station, which was the only state television station, would announce the results and say that the only party able to contest elections had won 100% with 100% turnout. So this all made voting look really sort of strange and absurd. I think people don't believe in voting because they think politicians and politics makes no difference, because they think that all politicians are the same, and ultimately voting is a pointless process that will result in no fundamental changes in their lives. In capitalism, which is unlike the communist system that I grew up in, money decides the processes and the ways in which people engage with each other, how much power they have to make arguments, who listens to them, who shapes the public debate. And so I think there is a legitimate criticism of the way in which what precedes elections is rigged by power and wealth inequalities. And yet what is interesting is that on election day, we all have one vote. They are the one day in which all citizens have equal power to change the laws of the country that they live into. There's one exception to that, which is if you are a migrant, then you don't have that power, then that power is denied to you. I have been in the United Kingdom for almost 10 years, and like many other millions of migrants in the United Kingdom, I will be excluded on that day. There will be a process that will shape the lives of millions of citizens. It will shape in particular the lives of the EU citizens who will be subject to whatever Brexit decision the winning party will end up making, and who will not have been able to have a say in those parties and to vote for the policies and the principled approach to Brexit that best fits their views. Please register to vote. Make sure that you exercise the right to vote, because the right to vote is actually not only a right, it's also a responsibility, and it's the responsibility of those who have the power to vote to exercise that power on behalf of those who don't.
That was Professor Leah Upi. My thanks to her and to Sean Walker. This episode was produced by Rachel Humphreys, Chika Ayres and Courtney Youssef. Sound design was by Axel Cacoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.